Oak Creek City Council to order, and as always, we begin with the Pledge of Allegiance, please.
Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mayor Pruitt?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw?
Here.
Councilmember Cavallari?
Here.
Councilmember Todd?
Here.
Councilmember Bond?
Here.
Councilmember Steckler?
Here.
Councilmember Vignell?
Here.
Okay, and typically we begin with audience communication. There's only one person signed up, but there's been a request for a presentation. Bob?
I'll start with the typical. John Raymer, 831 148th Street Southeast here in Mill Creek. And I'm here to talk on two different things. First, we would like, I'm here representing the commander of AMVETS Post 2018, and we would like to give Councilman Cavallari a little appreciation for donating a wonderful American flag from a veteran to us. We're in the process of getting it mounted in a nice box, and we're going to put it somewhere, hopefully in a permanent place for display for everyone who comes and visits. The AMVETS Post is now up to 32 different members, and we're growing very much. And it's due to the great support from the council and from Councilman Cavallari. So I'm going to give you a little plaque here.
I'm photobombing.
Oh, shit, they are getting right in front of us.
And now I'll try to keep it to three, but you'll think you'll let me finish. So as the council is probably aware, I applied for the position of city manager, and I thought that you might like some feedback on how the process went from an unsuccessful applicant's side of the equation. I'll start off with two words, which are integrity first. It's not just the Air Force creed. It's my personal creed. I lived it for 25 years on active duty in uniform. I've lived it every day in the 8 years since I retired. What integrity first means is I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not going to omit information. I'm not going to leave things out to make the other people look bad or better or whatever. I'm going to tell you the honest truth. And the honest truth is the representative from Peckham and McKinney threw the council under the bus. And here's how he did it. I applied. The deadline came. The deadline went. I heard nothing. So I called him up and I asked, what's going on? And he said, we put you in the no pile. And I asked why. He said, you have no experience. And I said, well, do you consider military command experience as management of civilians? And he went, no. Then he followed up with, military management is completely different than civilian management. His exact words. And I said, well, hold on. I was a base commander. Base city commander manager, exact same duties, just in military words. I had a police department. I had a public works. I had a housing area. I had streets. I had sewers. I had 120 people. My budget was $370 million a year. I had annual appraisals, promotions, bonuses. I had an IT department, did purchases, government travel, all that kind of stuff. And he said, oh, okay. Well, I'll tell you, we'll be nice and we'll give you an interview and the questionnaire. So I got the questionnaire, filled it out, real easy. It was hard keeping it down to six pages. Sent it in to him. But the conversation on the phone, within 30 seconds, I knew absolutely he was not going to recommend me in any way, form, or fashion. And then the night that he gave you guys the list of candidates, he called me up on the phone and said, this is the end of your journey to be a city council or city manager. And I said, well, okay, can I have some feedback as to why? And here's where he threw you guys under the bus. He said, you are a hard sell. You have no experience being a city manager. and I just could not convince the council to give you an interview. Those were his words to me. I'm fairly certain that's not what the topic of discussion when he had his private conversation with you guys. It seems to me that I began this with two words, and I want to end it with two words. Their whole search was about city manager. And that conversation I had with him told me that they had no idea on how to evaluate military personnel and their experiences. I started with integrity first. I want to end with integrity first. What it means to me. The new city manager, Chiaravino, however pronounce it correctly, whatever he asks of me, I will be happy to do. If it's within my abilities to do it for the city, then I will do that for the city, and I will frankly be honored to help in any way that I can. I hope that the city never has to do another executive council for many, many years. But the thing that I want to say as a piece of advice to the council is, should you need to do another executive search, a company that passes the buck, the right way to say it, that cannot adequately perform the duties that you paid them a lot of money to do and passes the blame for that inadequacy off instead of addressing it, is probably not a company that you should do business with. And my advice is, if I may be so bold, the next time we need to do this, please do not hire Peckham and McKinney. I know this is just a speaking session, but if any of you would like me to talk to you in private or in public, I'm more than happy to do that. I'm an open book. I'm going to tell you the honest truth. I'll meet with you anytime you want, either on email, in person, whatever you prefer. And I'm very happy with the person that we picked. I think he's going to be an awesome guy. And I look forward to doing whatever I can for the city for many years to come. Thank you for letting me go over 3 minutes. Appreciate it.
Active civic participation, and whereas the city has many dedicated volunteers who serve at the city to build a strong community, and whereas volunteers are motivated by the simple satisfaction of helping their fellow citizens and making their community a better place to live, and whereas these individuals have become a vital and positive force in our community and have demonstrated a common conviction that the well-being of the community is largely dependent on helping others, and whereas National Volunteer Week was established in 1974 and for the last 45 years has been a time to honor and recognize volunteers, now therefore I, Pam Pruitt, the mayor of the city of Mill Creek, on behalf of the city council, do hereby proclaim the week of April 7th through the 13th, 2019, as National Volunteer Week in Mill Creek, and honor the hard work and selfless dedication of our volunteers who make Mill Creek a better place to live and work. Thank you. And we just couldn't do or have a city as great as this one without all of our volunteers. So thank you. Next up is old business, settlement agreement between the City of Mill Creek and Comcast regarding franchise fee audit and review. Bob?
Thank you, Mayor. This is old business because it was on the agenda at the last week's meeting. However, we pulled it prior to this discussion because staff wanted to collect some more information before council. And so we've collected that information from outside council, and our finance director will share that with you and address any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Bob. Good evening, Mayor and Council. As Bob indicated, we're here to talk about the settlement agreement between the city and Comcast. We engaged a law firm, Cohen Law Group, to do an audit of the franchise fees that they were remitting to the city. And through that review, we found that they had underpaid what was owed to us. And the amount in which they assessed the 5% was about $1,750,000. And so when they calculated that through, we came up to fee on fee revenue had an underpayment of $87,000. And then there was another component that was TV revenue guide, which was under $10, so nothing material there. And given that the amount over this five-year period was over 3%, they also had to incur the audit fees, which was $5,310. Now, the actual agreement suggests that there was an underpayment and penalty. There is no penalty included in this $92,000. It's merely made up of the underpayment for the fees and then also the audit. Now, there were a couple of questions that were raised, and I'd like to bring those up so that everybody has the benefit of the information. The first question was, since the underpayment penalty was Comcast's error, why do they charge our customers this fee? And the reason is because it's allowable by the law. So they are allowed to charge the fee through to the customers that are currently Comcast customers. So they don't go back. That was another question. Do the current people within our city limits pick up this underpayment fee? And the answer is yes. They don't go back and administratively try to look for those people that were there during the underpayment period. The other question, which I think I can understand why it raises some confusion, the franchise fee is calculated at 5%, so that $1,745,000 of fee, if you tack on the 5%, generated the $87,000. That's statutory law, and that's what they're allowed to pass on. But then also within the agreement, there's this 6.99%, which is the amount that Comcast is permitted from or prohibited from going over on any one month. So currently on the bill, it says franchise fee, and that'll be the current franchise fee at 5% on the current product offering that a consumer is utilizing, but they'll also be able to charge an extra amount that's capped out at 6.99%. And Comcast has gone through the math and has calculated that based on those services, everybody's services might be different. Vince might have a Comcast bill for 100 where maybe John just utilizes internet and his is 50. So through their calculation, they've calculated it'll take 24 months to recoup this $92,000. To our customers or our residents. That's it in a nutshell. If anybody has any questions, I'm happy to entertain them to the best of my ability.
Yeah, thanks, Peggy. Thanks, staff, Bob, as well, for working on this for me. And I apologize. I didn't get the last question to Peggy early enough to give a satisfactory answer. So I'm going to be abstaining tonight because I just feel like there's not enough information on this. But my concern was this, and Peggy addressed the first one. When it came to us last week, it talked about underpayments and penalties. And I was concerned that our contract was penalizing them for undercharging on the franchise fees. And all these are going to get passed back through to residents who are customers of Comcast. And I just felt like our penalty, the windfall for the city of a penalty, would be inappropriate to go back on residents. I'm looking out for the residents and thinking what's fair. That is not the case, as Peggy pointed out tonight. Thank you. That it's just the underpayment of the franchise fees. I fundamentally have, I guess this is an old contract. Peggy reminded me that we've got a new contract now. But this contract, the $87,000 comes from fees on fees. Basically, our contract required Comcast to have a 5% franchise fee. So if you had a $100 franchise bill, that was gross revenue, $5 would be added onto that. Comcast was allowed to charge that, and they were supposed to pay us the $5. Through the wording of the contract, that $5 they pay us is also gross revenue. And so they're supposed to pay us 5% of that 5%. And technically, once they do that, and the $92,000 here is, again, a franchise fee, under the old contract, that's another 5%. So you get this iterative calculation. Somehow the contract got worded in a funny fashion. The math is weird. But effectively, we are charging people, we'll be charging people 5.26%, which is above the federal limit of 5%. We don't have time to work this out through the East Coast law firm that's doing this. I'm just not very impressed by their math. I'm also concerned about the recovery. The settlement agreement says they can recover, and apparently federal law allows them to recover at up to 6.9%, 99%. But I'm looking right here in the In the summary, it says, pursuant to Section 6223 of the Federal Cable Act, a cable operator is legally able to pass through all franchise fee payments to current subscribers so long as the amount does not exceed 5% of gross revenue. So until I see that there's an exception for going back for what they failed to do from 2011 to 2017, I'm just not comfortable passing that on. So I'm going to abstain because I have lack of information. I apologize. Thanks.
I don't think maybe this isn't clear, and I can go back and get more clarity, but the 5% that they're allowed to charge is legally what they can charge. It also allows them to recoup any amounts that they could have charged that they didn't. Now, they don't have to, but practically that's never done. They always, cable companies always go back and charge the consumers the amount of the franchise fee or the underpayment penalty. They don't absorb that and say, whoops, it was our mistake, so we're going to be good stewards and pay that ourselves. They go back and charge the consumers.
It great explanation. I appreciate what staff has done. I apologize for not getting the final bit of my question till staff till this afternoon. I'm not time to fully for me to fully research the federal code because I've got to see it to believe it. Peggy addressed it, and Bob addressed it earlier too. And unfortunately, this was people who underpaid or didn't get charged the full amount, so therefore the city didn't get the full amount back in early 2010s. But the current subscribers, so somebody who signed up tomorrow for Comcast, will be paying this for the next X months until the $92,000 recovered. It's just the way it is. It's just tough luck, but I just don't feel like I'm ready to vote in favor of this to impose that.
No, they can't charge 5%, so that was the reason that the 6.99%, it prohibits them from, A, charging the whole $92,000 in 1 month, that they have to share it ratably so that it's capped at the 6.99% on a monthly basis. So they'll have the 5% that they would charge monthly, and then they'll have an incremental difference to recoup the $92,000, and it'll be on a line item called franchise fees.
Staff summary that quotes the federal law that says it's limited to 5. Our contract, through this iterative calculation, which was an error, and I believe an error in how the legal words were constructed, caused it to effectively be 5.25 is what we're doing now. Technically, it should have been 5.26 with a remainder after that. But anything over 5, I don't know how we can charge. So it's a catch-22, an impossibility between what our contract says and what they've negotiated, this law firm negotiated on our behalf to recover these funds. And so Comcast said, sure, we'll do it. But it's easy for them to say that because they're going to turn right back around and charge our customers. There's no skin off of their whatever to do this other than the hassle factor. And they probably said, well, we'll just forget this and write it off. And hopefully our new contract is better. This contract apparently has expired. And there's a new one, and I'd forgotten that. So thanks to staff for filling me in. Again, for me personally, I haven't had my questions answered. This is probably the right thing to do for the city because the city didn't get this money along the way. I'm just struggling with how we can do that because I don't see that it complies with federal law from what I know so far. And I don't mean to doubt what Peggy's saying. I'm looking at one statement, and I don't see all the data yet. And again, I apologize that I didn't have a chance to research it myself this afternoon or to give staff enough time to work on it.
I make sure I understand it correctly. So the franchise fee that Comcast charged was not enough.
Correct.
Discovered this. And the fee that is owed to the city.
Correct.
And Comcast, who was at error for not charging it, and the city that was at error for not noticing that it wasn't the right fee, or is there?
We wouldn't notice that. We have a section in our agreement with them that allows us the right to go back and audit And we said while we were doing the renegotiation of the agreement, we said for $5,300 it's probably worth going back and doing an audit. You know, so hopefully that will stop this prospectively, because now they're aware of it. You know, I would assume that the years that we've had this audit or this agreement, we've probably missed out on a lot of franchise fees, but that wasn't the scope of the audit.
So there's no way we would know?
No, we would not know.
So it really, the one that was an error here was Comcast.
Correct.
And the solution is to
start charging existing customers of Comcast as of today an extra fee to recoup this.
Right. Limited to the 5% that they already have the legal authority to do, and the legal authority under this section 6223 to go back and recoup those fees, because they would have been able to charge it anyway.
We all are struggling here with, that doesn't seem fair to the current Comcast customers.
I do not disagree with that.
So is this an adequate solution? It doesn't sound like it is the right solution to me. I don't know what the solution is, but going back to the existing customers doesn't sound like the right thing to do, because there are customers today that have only been on for a month, and they're gonna pay this, and that.
Right, and you don't have a choice as to going back and recouping it from
right.
those customers that were in the audit period. It's only prospectively.
Of course, Comcast doesn't want to pay it unless they can collect it.
Right, and legally they have that option to do. They're not going to pay it without recouping it. They're not obligated under this section, but practically that never happens. They don't pony up the money because they made the error. Somebody pays for it, and unfortunately it's the consumers.
So the tough decision here is that we make decisions based on what's in the right interest of the citizens and the city. So the city's owed this money. We should collect the money. But collecting from the citizens may not be the right thing. In some cases, it's clearly not the right thing. It's totally unfair. That's a bit of a quandary. I don't know if this is the – it doesn't seem like the right solution to me. I can't see how I could approve that, but I just noticed that my wise associate to my right just clicked on his light, so I'm going to defer to Council Member Bond. Mayor Pro Tem was before. Okay.
Just to follow up on that point, I want to make sure we're clear. We don't have a choice of whether we allow or not allow Comcast to seek the reimbursement from the ratepayers. That's determined
correct.
By federal law. As I understand, the issue is the percentage and whether that's consistent with what federal law allows, the 6.99 versus 5. Is that correct?
That was my concern, is that the part of the code that I see in the agenda summary says 5 is the max. And so there presumably could be another part of the code that says, in the case that cable provider have messed up, you're allowed to go 1.99 more than the 5% to make up for your past error. But I don't know that.
Yeah, so, John, it is, I mean, the city was entitled to this money, but at the same time, the ratepayers got the benefit of the service they received, and they would have paid for this had it been done correctly by Comcast. So, I mean, I guess I hate to say it this way. It is what it is. I guess to move this forward, I would suggest, why don't we just alter that one sentence to take out the reference to the 6.99% and just say, under no circumstances shall Comcast charge more of gross revenues in any one month as a franchise fee than is permitted by federal law. And that way we don't have to debate whether it's 5% or 6.99%, and the attorneys can figure out what is allowed or not allowed and move this forward.
Yeah, I think that's just a quick question to the attorney if 6.99 is statutory or if that's something that they came up with. What we don't want to do is give them carte blanche to charge anything they want, because then they could do it in a single month.
No, I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting that you just, instead of referring to a percentage, we just say charge in any one month no more than what is permitted by federal law or applicable law or whatever the appropriate phrase would be.
Certainly do that. I'd only be concerned if federal law would allow something more than that 6.99%. But we could ask that question of the legal counsel that we've been utilizing for the last year. Any settlement that you authorize, of course, would have to be approved by them. And if it's not, then the bottom line is that there is no settlement and there is no fund.
I guess I'm confused again then. If federal law dictates their ability to charge this back to the customers, why do we need this in the contract? Why do we need the proviso?
The 6.99?
And whatever the percentage, whether it's 5 or 6.99, why do we have it in there under no circumstance? Do we have the ability to dictate that? I thought it's dictated by federal law.
I think, as I understood from the legal counsel, is that that was to prohibit Comcast from charging the entire $92,000 at one time to the subscribers.
Oh, so they 1 month. Oh, they could do that.
So this was simply trying to spread those costs out, at least according to Comcast, over a 24-month period. Rather than all at once.
My fix wouldn't work.
This is on the order of, if you have a $100 cable bill, working backwards, it's on the order of $20-25 per subscriber that you're going to pay over eight. Or, I believe they can collect it 9 months, but they're saying 24, so something like that. And it's going to appear on the bill as some sort of franchise fee. I don't know what the original 5% looks like on a Comcast bill.
How much time do I have to go to Dish, and how long do I have to be on Dish?
We'll start doing this in May.
So what I heard, first, I didn't see it quite the way Councilmember Todd did, and I appreciate you putting it in that light. If I heard Peggy right, they've been paying us something. They just didn't pay us everything that...
Right, they missed the fee.
But they weren't collecting it and not giving it to us. They just actually weren't even collecting it.
Correct.
And you said if we went back farther, we'd find more.
Well, I'm just conjecturing.
But it's speculation based on logic.
Yeah. Just,
so we are essentially leaving money on the table anyway right now as we speak. So to leave another $87,000 on the table, so we're just... We're essentially taxing the citizens, right? Comcast isn't going to – it's not like you made a mistake, pay up, and learn from it. It's just, we'll just pass it on.
Yeah.
So the easy thing here is to not pass it on and just move forward. We didn't budget for it. We – on the citizens, not – that's where you're going, right? I mean, I'm just taking your comments to the logical conclusion. And that's where I land when I – process it. We've already left some money on the table. It's a one-time thing. It's not like we're giving up future revenues for a long, long time. We just caught them in the error, and it being the big picture thing, it's kind of a small error, really, isn't it? Or no?
Well, it was $1.7 million that they overlooked on assessing a fee for, I mean, if you figure out how many households there are in Mill Creek,
the other side of it is, thank you. The other side of it is this $50 and $100 Comcast bills don't exist. It's $150 and $250, so it's a lot more for everybody I know. So I just took a box back to try and save myself $10, and now I'm finding out I'm going to get hit for $20 more because my bill runs around $200. Oh, it's not a monthly?
No. It's spread over 24 months.
All right. Well, I like, I mean, it's a police car. There's things we need. There's public works needs out there. I get that there's, we could always use $87,000, but if you came to me and said, hey, we'll do a utility tax for $87,000, I'd say, no, I'm not going to pass that on to our citizens.
Yeah, it's almost 1.3 in property tax increase. It's not a utility tax. This is an agreement that...
It's not. We're not saying
that. Yeah.
What are our options on this?
Do nothing.
I think that's really the bottom line. I wish we were utilizing a local law firm that could provide some more information to us, but we're using an East Coast law firm, so we're getting limited information. We've been working with that law firm for a number of months, maybe a year, but I think it really is, it's a matter of we either reach a settlement and collect the fee or just not execute the settlement and forego the fee and forego the revenue.
We would pay that.
Well, actually, I misspoke.
I don't know what the answer to that would be.
Well,
if they would pass that through.
Suppose they could pass the $5,000 on to the same subscribers at a much lower rate.
I don't know that that's the case. I would have to inquire about that.
Yes, I would propose that we, I mean, it's rubbing me wrong that we would just collect this money from the Comcast to have them turn around and have the citizens pay it. So I guess I'd be more inclined to propose a settlement that says we'll walk away from the underpayment if they pay for the audit and don't seek to recoup that $5,000 from the through the rates and call it good.
We can always try to negotiate that. They would be, since the audit, and this is just me speculating, since the audit, they're triggered to pay the audit because of the amount was over 3%. My sense would be they do have the ability to go back and charge that to the customers, but I would, again, want to seek counsel to have a definitive answer. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. I think this will be a simpler discussion, I hope. So, what I propose is an increase in the Mill Creek Municipal Code, raising the city manager's contract authority level from $50,000 to $100,000. All the contracts that are issued by the city manager have to be supported by the city's budget. So that's also a requirement that will continue moving forward. And the reason for that increase is while I was preparing new procedures that match up and align with the City Council's current policy on procurement of goods and services, I noticed and discovered an inconsistency between those regulations, the city's current procedures, and what I was drafting in terms of new procedures that were meant to be provide more internal controls than what our current five-page document does today. Those administrative procedures are what the city prepares in order to implement the City Council's policy, much the same way the personnel policies, you remember when we had that discussion, these procedures would do the same thing in terms of implementing the Council's policies on procurement of goods and services. So, within the current procedures, it allows the city to, or the city manager to execute contracts or change orders up to $50,000 or 10%, whichever is greater. And obviously, we have many contracts, or you could have the possibility of many contracts that would far exceed $50,000 given that 10% clause. And so I was trying to come up with a simplistic method that would look at all the change orders and look at amendments to the contracts in the same fashion and actually look at them and the cumulative impact of all those. And so whenever something hit $100,000, the city manager would no longer have any authority to issue any more amendments or change orders on that contract. They'd always have to come back to the City Council. So that's the purpose of the proposed change. I've included the procedures in there for transparency so that you can see how they will be implemented. Or at least see how that policy that you adopted previously would be implemented. It's in draft form. There are some terms in the procedures that I'd want to tighten up a bit just to put some more belt and suspenders to the language so that it was clear in all sections that this is always going to be the cumulative impact of authorities. In other words, you can't have a $99,000 contract and then the next day add a $2 contract without that coming back to the City Council for approval. And so that's why the procedure is in there. There's also an acknowledgement or a section in the back in regards to conflicts of interest. There's some pretty broad statements in that conflicts that not only staff but but I'd ask the city council to sign, because you also have a duty as elected officials when you authorize contracts to make sure that you also identify appropriately the potential conflicts. Those are some pretty broad statements I want to tighten up a little bit so that you're not always identifying all of the financial relationships or personal interests associated with business that happens in the city. So the recommendation for you this evening is to make that adjustment from $50,000 to $100,000. I will then align that with the procedures so that all contracts or change orders have authority up to $100,000, and anything more than that requires council approval. I'd be glad to address questions that council might have about the proposed ordinance. Thank you, Mayor. I don't have any comps. I would tell you that 50 to 100 is probably where they're going to fall. Some also would have, and this is just based on experience, some would have a different contract authority for change orders than they would contract amendments, which to me doesn't necessarily align. I think it's much easier for staff and then for the public to have just one limit and not have a different threshold for change order contracts versus consultant contracts or architectural engineering contracts. So it's probably going to fall within that 50 to 100. Just some history. When I was here earlier, during the first term as city manager, the contract authority was $30,000, and it was limited for professional service contracts. Everything outside of that was some other amount or didn't have any amount. Somewhere along the lines, the city went from 30 to 50 and then included all the contracts. But that's all the information I have, Mayor, is more anecdotal than it is any sort of survey information about what other jurisdictions are doing. As an alternative, if you decided not to raise it, I would keep, if you wanted to keep the $50,000, I would simply modify the procedures, because I think better procedures, more controls are necessary for the city beyond the five-page document that we have now. And then I would also remove the clause in our procedures that calls out $50,000 or 10%, whichever is greater, and probably be just $50,000 as a limit, and anything above 50 would require council approval.
Thank you. And City Manager Stowe and I talked about this afternoon. So this came about, let's back up. This is really good. We're taking our very old policy manual that we ran into some troubles with for whatever reason in the process of all of our troubles over the last year or so, uncovered that our policy manual is very old and wasn't very good. And so I applaud staff for really doing a lot of stuff to bring this up to what, almost 20 years worth of stuff that needed to be corrected. So that's great. In the process, as City Manager Stowe pointed out, found this $50,000 or 10% or the greater, which is logically incompatible. And so one way to fix that is to take out the or greater part and just make $50,000, as you suggested. So that is one consideration, and I think that's one way to fix this. The other way to fix it is to say, let's simultaneously change the city manager's limit from 50 to 100. And then this all, the draft procedure manual also has department directors moving up to 30,000. And that, if 100,000 is for the city manager, I think 30,000 is right for department directors. But I would pose that to the council too, what we want to do. For me, but I could be easily outvoted on this, but I'll throw it out there. For me, we've come through a period where we've had a lot of consternation about our procurement policies and issues that have been here. We've got a couple brand new, fairly new council members who may not have had a chance to go through the AWC or MRC budgeting and procurement training yet, and so this may be something that they're ready to go on or maybe not, but I think it's entirely appropriate for us, regardless, to work as a council with our new city manager to talk about the entire process of budgeting and how we spend our money so that we're all understanding budgeting and municipal finance adequately so we can watch the funds. For me, I think our citizens have told us loud and clear they want us to keep close eye on the checkbook. And so right now, for me, changing from 50 to 100,000, as much as I trust this city manager and I will trust our next city manager, I just think it's this is not the time to change that one thing. I'd like to do that over a period of time, but I'm fully in support of having this new manual get in place as soon as we can. Thanks.
Correct. The procurement manual now is aligned with the $100,000 change. If it were not, it would need to be aligned with the $50,000 with the current $50,000 standard. And just once again, whatever limit you have, obviously they need to be followed. But secondly, there always has to be supported by the city's budget. And so whether it's $25,000, $50,000, or $100,000 or more, it has to be supported by the city's budget.
So the question here is right now we've got this problem. It says $50,000 or 10% or the greater, and that is illogical, and so there's this thing you tried to help us fix. Could we modify this ordinance to say the number is 100,000 instead of 100,000, it just says 50? Would that work? And pass the ordinance tonight with that and move forward that way?
Because the ordinance already has 50,000, and so if you don't want to raise the limit, you don't have to do anything. 50,000 is the current standard now, or the current requirement in the code, and it's also needs to be supported by the city's budget, or it has some other language in there about being supported by ordinance or policy or directive of the city council.
That's covered in the existing, very old, very brief policy.
That's right.
Adequate there.
And I should have started off with this. Sorry for not an appropriate lead-in, but the reason why this is coming to you, as I was, of course, preparing the new procedures manual, noticed this inconsistency. And so before I can finalize that, I need to determine whether or not council's interested in moving forward with the $100,000 limit, or if you'd like to retain the $50,000 limit. That's already in a procedure, Mayor, and so there's no action the council would need to take. Regardless of what you do this evening, the procedures are going to eliminate that 10% clause. That's my intention. That's what I'll put in the procedures. I just need to know what the upper limit is for the city manager.
Thanks.
I agree with Pam and with Mike. Let's keep the 50,000, would be my opinion right now. I don't think raising it's an issue, but I would recommend keeping it at 50, and I appreciate your changes to take out that goofy clause.
That's just one of the changes in the procedures manual, but that's an important
big one.
Though. Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah, when I started seeing my name on some of the documents, it becomes a little old, yes.
Okay, so you can come for one for that tonight.
Thank you. Oh, it's actually going to be the Public Works Director. She's going to lead us through a discussion and address any questions that council might have on the purchase of the bucket truck. Crazy.
Good evening, council. Yes, we do. Or stronger arms, one of the two. Good evening, Council. So for tonight's topic of the purchase of the Public Works bucket truck, I'll be presenting, and later in the presentation, Nathan Beagle will be joining me. So we'll be covering three main topics, some general background on bucket trucks. We'll be talking a little bit about the characteristics of our existing bucket truck, and then we'll also be talking about the characteristics of the new bucket truck. So what is a bucket truck? A bucket truck is a truck equipped with an extendable hydraulic boom carrying a large bucket for raising workers to elevated, inaccessible areas. Bucket trucks are regulated under OSHA standard guidelines, and that must be used for safety of those operating the truck. So those are just some general terms of bucket trucks. This is a picture, a generic picture of what a bucket truck looks like. So it's more or less a pickup with a hydraulic boom or arm and a bucket in which the worker stands so that he or she can reach inaccessible areas such as trees or signs or streetlights. So when preparing the 2019-2020 budget last year, we identified the bucket truck as our priority piece of equipment to purchase in this biennium. Our current bucket truck is a 1998 Chevy Altec bucket truck. And as an FYI, so it's 21 years old, and in the last biennium, that's the 2017-2018 biennium, we spent approximately $14,000 in maintenance costs. So that has a dollar amount, but it also has an interruption in service because when it goes to the mechanic, we're not able to conduct our operations. So for the next few slides, Nathan Beagle is going to talk a little bit about the existing bucket truck, uses of bucket trucks, and then characteristics of the new bucket truck. So Nathan.
Thank you, Gina. Council. This is just our current bucket truck. We use the bucket truck in day-to-day operations for things like removing trees safely, operating, repairing street lights, hanging banners, and various other things. This is our current bucket truck we're using to take down a tree on Village Green Drive. And this is earlier on in the operation when the tree's a bit taller. It's a much safer operation to be able to section a tree down, especially when it's over a right-of-way next to a roadway or, over walkways and stuff like that. So it's safer for the public and much safer for the operator. We utilize the bucket truck for doing street signs, street lights. This operation is working on some street signs. The bucket truck's also an insulated lift, so that has it's basically insulated against electrical interruptions. So when you're working on street lights, it's much safer for the operator, and other people. Absolutely. Matter of fact, we'll get into that too, because the current bucket truck is getting a little short for that tree. the new bucket truck we're proposing is actually about 4 feet longer reach. So we'll be able to continue decorating the tree. We also use bucket truck during like emergency operations for storm removal stuff. When there's trees that are partially down over the roadway, we can safely get in there, take the trees out, emergency operations during windstorms and such. But obviously you're able to also get up there when there's like widowmaker limbs that are hanging above the street, stuff like that. We're able to get up and remove those, so safer for the public. Widowmaker. It's just a term used, I guess, in the tree and forestry logging industry. It's just referring to a limb that's hung up in a tree and the poor guy underneath it that's going to soon be make a widow. So that's where that term comes from. But during our research, we had companies come here. We also went to City of Mercer Island and checked out their bucket truck.
spoke with the City of Sammamish, Snohomish County Public Works, many private companies. Got a lot of input from them. Through our conclusion was we wanted to go with a Duralift 39. It's basically a 39-foot boom, and it is basically built to order. So right now they're at 280 days build time for these trucks. And so conditions on council approval, then we could be ready in January 2020. We still do have our bucket truck. It's still in operation. However, well, it doesn't get traded in. It's so old. They kind of laugh when you talk about trading in. Probably what we intend to do with the bucket truck upon conclusion is, probably put it out for auction, basically. Go through procedures through that.
I'm glad to see you moved away from the diesel idea. It's kind of the next step.
Yeah. There's, I can go into some of that too, but the diesel, there's a few advantages. The gas versus the diesel, there's a few different advantages to that, particularly in the city here, but they're also a lot quieter, the gas engines versus the diesels. So, but.
Well, we have one resource available for diesel fuel, so if they close down, they're the only game in town, right? We're just kind of stuck like Chuck.
Yep, that's true too.
What happened this year.
And this actually is the City of Mercer Island bucket truck. And the truck we're proposing getting is basically pretty close to identical to this truck. Some of the added safety features to this truck, we currently do not have outriggers on our truck. This truck has H-style outriggers, helps stabilize the platform. That would be this portion right here. It makes for a much steadier platform. The Public Works crew will much appreciate that. It also comes with a safety canopy over the cab of the truck. We're often working on emergency situations with trees overhanging the road where you're operating up over the top of the cab. This prevents if you drop a wrench or a tree branch or something like that from damaging the vehicle. So it protects the investment, makes it a little safer. And then also there's a cone rack built into the bumper on top. We don't currently have that, so that just makes things quicker, more accessible to set up safety zones for the work crew. And then incorporated inside the rack at the back corners here on both sides, there's some safety lights. It's much more high visible than our current bucket truck. And then one thing you wouldn't be able to see on this picture, on the rear of the bucket truck, there would also be a traffic advisor or arrow bar. This is often what you see like on a police car when they're trying to divert traffic around a situation. So these are kind of some of the added safety features that you get the truck with.
Four-wheel drive.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to, I guess, implement that expensive of a piece of equipment for plowing. Plowing tends to be pretty rough on equipment. So it's not something you want to go plow a street with and then crawl up and go 40 feet up in the air right afterwards. It's a lot of it. And there might be even some stuff in OSHA, I don't know. But obviously it's OSHA regulated, so you got to have the proper safety inspections, safety equipment, all that stuff. So this vehicle would not be four-wheel drive because it wouldn't be used for plowing and such. That's through our research for staff, that's what we've come up with anyway.
Is the current vehicle four-wheel drive?
No, it's not.
Okay.
I got a few more slides, but and hopefully I'll answer any questions before you're going to ask them. But anyway, this is a rented vehicle through, that City of Sammamish have. and they've come to the conclusion that's much cheaper to own. They're in the process of actually procuring a bucket truck as well. But it's an insulated piece of equipment. It does help, actually, if you store it inside it. It's not like your standard car when you go to wash it and keep it clean. It does take a few hours to actually clean it. And then cleaning it, it's not just a matter of looks. It also helps. It's an insulated piece of equipment, so you got to properly clean it in order to have it safely insulated for electrical stuff. But that is a stabilizer on this vehicle. This is a different vehicle, but the other truck, back a slide, I showed you the stabilizers, has something similar. And it also helps when you store a vehicle inside, too. Helps keep it in much better shape and keeps it from deteriorating as fast.
Do we have an interior
parking for this vehicle?
Yeah, right now we currently just have the one bay, so it's I guess it's a very overutilized bay because it's just, we have the one spot, so for winter operations and stuff, sometimes we've got to bring vehicles in there, but some of the time we can't have that in there, but we just have to kind of switch vehicles around depending on what operation we're doing because we don't have a lot of space. And then to go over some of more of the financial aspects of this vehicle, I was going to bring back up Gina Hortolosa.
Thanks, Nathan. So this table on the screen is a summary of the cost breakdown for the DuraLift bucket truck. And so the base cost is just shy of $123,000. And then there's some additional features, mostly safety features that Nathan pointed out early that are a little bit over $6,000. And so the total cost of the bucket truck that we're interested in purchasing is $129,225.27. This is within the budget that was allocated in the 2019-2020 biennium budget. In the budget, we actually had $151,000, and that's was composed of two parts, $31,000 from the equipment replacement fund and $120,000 from the capital outlay. Also, we are following our city's policy 300-02 for procurements, and this purchase falls within the $50,000 to $200,000, and so we're required to do competitive bids. And so per RCW 3934, what we're doing is what's called piggybacking on the state contract, which has already been competitively bid. And based on that, the lowest bidder for this particular truck is Nelson Truck Equipment for this dollar amount that's on the screen. That includes tax. The new bucket truck has three main capabilities that the existing bucket truck doesn't have. It has additional safety features. It has a longer reach of 4 feet, and it will also be more reliable. And that concludes our presentation. We'd be happy to answer any questions council has.
Thanks. As much as I'm with Councilmember Cavallari, I much prefer gas vehicles, but the question I asked the city manager was that the state legislature did us the favor, I'll put it in air quotes, a couple of years ago, that mandating everything had to be some sort of energy-efficient fuel, which was driving us all towards clean fuel diesel or biodiesel. I understand biodiesel is not available in town, but I want to make sure we're not running amok of the state law by specifying gas. And so I don't know if the city manager had a chance to fully research that state statute.
I did research the statutes, and they do call for that all vehicles after June 1 of 2015, to the extent determined practical, and then you have to go also another section of the RCW to determine what's determined practical, that you purchase equipment, excluding some pieces of equipment, police being one of those, that is use electricity or biofuel. So it's not practical for us to use biofuel because no biofuel is available. And there's a list of exemptions that determine practicality in terms of whether or not you can purchase other types of vehicles. So I think based on the statute, my reading, the Public Works Director, I think that we're covered and supported by this decision.
Yeah, and so I'll also add, if I may, that we did check into that. City of Bellevue actually last year purchased 2 hybrid bucket trucks. Not only is their initial cost higher, but they don't have enough time to recharge for daily operations, and so they are converting them back to gas, and it's costing them an additional $20,000 per bucket truck.
Yeah, I'm with you. The hybrids, community transit did a side-by-side, hybrid buses versus diesel buses, and they're way more expensive. So I fully concur with that. I just want to make sure we weren't running amok. It sounds like if they were specific about biodiesel, we can work around that. I just want to make sure.
The statute also allows for compressed natural gas or propane to be substituted for electricity also, or biofuel, but the same sort of issues for Mill Creek in terms of where do you purchase that for the vehicles.
Thank you. I'm glad we're a small town without very many fueling sources. That's good. Thanks.
Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Hey. Did I turn on? Thank you, Gina. This was a great presentation, and I think you handled all the information, and you answered the question that I was going to ask there at the end, because I wanted to know if it actually, the purchase fit within the budget, because I forgot to bring my budget. And so thank you for actually anticipating that we would ask that question and answering it for us. So thank you very much.
So what we need is a motion to authorize
the execute a capital asset request for the purchase of a new Ford F-50 truck with a DuraLift DTAX-39FP 39-foot aerial lift in the amount not to exceed $129,225.27.
Mayor, I'd like to propose that motion.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion?
I've got a question. So this says execute a capital asset request. Does that also authorize the city manager to spend the money? I'm not sure under a procurement policy. This is kind of different language I'm used to.
That would be the yes.
Okay.
I was wondering if you're going to give a very long answer. Yes.
Appreciate that.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Thank you, Mayor. That's a long title, but I'm very excited, subject to Council's approval at the next meeting, that we're going to be kicking off the sub-area planning process for Mill Creek Boulevard. This is a process that was discussed and included within the 2019-2020 budget. Sub-area planning processes are frequently used by cities as a launch point for redevelopment, reimagination, or revitalization of a certain area of interest for the community. And that's certainly true here in this case. We invited and interviewed some very talented consultant teams to help us with this process. And so I'm pleased to share with you, as you see in the agenda packet, we have selected OTAC as our consultant firm to help guide us through a very important community planning process. And Gina's going to kick things off with a few remarks and then invite our consultant to walk you through the scope of work that's being proposed in preparation for council acting on the consultant contract at your next meeting.
So only a couple of things before I introduce Mandy Roberts from OTAC. The first one is that when we prepared the 2019-2020 biannual budget, we actually were thinking at that time of 2 separate projects. We were thinking more of a planning project and then also separately a capital project, which is actually in our CIP for a Mill Creek Boulevard corridor study. As we got into more collective thinking about this project and what would be the best thing to do for the city, we landed on the conclusion that it would be better to hire a firm that could do both rather than one first and then followed by the other project. And so this project really is a hybrid of a planning and a public works project. So that's one thing I wanted to mention. And then the other thing is Mandy Roberts will have a presentation with multiple slides, and there's two main things that, besides providing all this information to council, we're interested in learning from council, your thoughts on this advisory committee that Mandy will be talking about, and then also how much involvement or presentations, how much engagement is council interested in having during this year-long project. So that said, I will transfer the mic to Mandy Roberts. Mandy Roberts is with OTAC. She's a vice president and partner at OTAC, and for this project, she functions as our project manager. Mandy.
Thank you, Gina. Good evening, council members. So tonight I would like to introduce myself and my firm and our team and tell you a little bit about our qualifications as well as our approach to the project that we've planned, and then finish up with some relevant experience that we have on other projects, and then we'll hopefully have a discussion and get your input on the two questions that Gina mentioned, the input on the advisory committee, and then also just, you know, kind of the level of council engagement in the process, and your weigh in on that tonight would be great. So I will start to go through these slides. So one of the things about our team that I think is really perfectly suited for this project is we do have that ability to go from planning to design, and my firm in particular is an interdisciplinary firm. So we have planners, architects, landscape architects, civil engineers, people who are specialists in stormwater management, which is an important part of this project, and other experts that are going to be working with us. And one of the things that we've planned, and we do frequently on other similar projects, is a really collaborative approach where we're working closely with you and your community in developing the plan and the design and taking that forward. And we do this through an extensive, robust community engagement process, which is what I lead. That's my area of expertise on these projects. Pretty exciting part of it. And we really focus on what are the opportunities to create a legacy place in the community that our community can be proud of. So we're really used to, and instead of just the planning and visioning side, really setting things up to move forward and be funded and constructed. And so I'm going to show you some projects where we've done that to give you a sense of that. And we have a really deep portfolio of experience in all of the things that are important to this project, including streets and trails and public place design and even transit facilities and transit-oriented development. We have the expertise on our team to help with funding and financing strategies, to think about what those next steps could be, whether it be the capital improvement side or the redevelopment side, and what kind of catalyst projects there might be as part of this vision, as well as are there public-private partnerships that we could look at within the sub-area. And then the last thing I want to say is we're really – as a team, we're really excited about this project because some of us are members of your greater community. For example, me, my dentist is in the sub-area, and my bank, and I grocery shop, and I buy things for my pets there. So I'm pretty excited to have this opportunity to work 5 minutes from home. Usually I'm working around the country or in other places, so it's really kind of a unique situation. So this just is a snapshot of our team. We've listed the project stakeholders here, which are many, including property owners and groups and community members, as well as agencies such as Community Transit, WashDOT, and others. And then within our team, as I mentioned, we have all the expertise that we need, including the community engagement and public involvement side and planning, land use planning, as well as the civil engineering and looking at infrastructure analysis as part of that. A couple of sub-consultants we have on the team. One is Leland Consulting Group from Portland, Oregon. They are really one of the best consultants in the Northwest when it comes to looking at a market assessment and understanding how the market is in the region and how that might affect redevelopment potential here, as well as identifying economic development opportunities for communities and partnering and financing opportunities that go with that. We also have transportation. 10W is a transportation consultant. They have been involved in the SWIFT project, the bus rapid transit project in the highway, and so they bring a lot of knowledge and already a lot of experience understanding the traffic conditions in this area, and that we'll be able to leverage that as part of our analysis for this project. So we've designed a pretty detailed project approach, and I'll just break it down into four elements. We have the first stage of work, which is really starting the project out and communicating, the next stage, which is reviewing and assessing existing conditions, the third stage, envisioning and analyzing, and the fourth stage, planning and designing in the subarea and the corridor. Perhaps the most important thing to mention tonight is we've been working with staff to identify how we would move forward with the engagement plan. We have a very robust plan with many meetings and workshops and the idea of really getting the community involved, and let's dream a little bit about this subarea and how it might transform and take shape over time. So we will have workshop sessions. Those are shown in the dark blue stars. We'll have a visioning workshop series as well as a scenarios workshop series and an open house. And then, as Gina mentioned, the orange stars represent convening of an advisory committee that would include representatives from the community that we would meet with on a regular basis to at key milestones during the planning and design process. So the workshop series, again, the workshops and the open house tie in with key milestones of the process, including reporting on our review of existing conditions and part of the process of envisioning and analyzing those conditions and putting together a vision for the subarea, and then lastly, the planning and design process. So now I'm just going to quickly go through, because I don't want to take too much time, but I just want to quickly go through and show you some of our experience in community and stakeholder engagement. We've been really doing this as part of our projects for decades, and we design each process to really fit each community and the stakeholders there. But as I mentioned, for this subarea, we're planning to have workshop series. We frequently include in those workshop series things like visual preference surveys, where we ask people to look at different examples of redevelopment or built form and give us a sense of what their preferences are, what they'd like to see, what the styles are. We also include walking tours, focus group sessions, stakeholder groups. We've talked about, for example, convening a developer focus group and talking with developers of this region and maybe from Portland and get a sense of what they think the potential could be for this subarea and maybe generating some interest in potential redevelopment. So we will be meeting with a lot of diverse groups and incorporating a lot of different activities into our outreach process. And one thing I wanted to mention, as you can see from this example, is we also like to get perspectives from the next generation of people, because the next generation, which are our kids in school and our students, are the ones that are going to realize the benefits of how this place changes. So frequently as part of our workshop process, we'll go out to the schools and classrooms and get input from the students, in addition to doing the workshop sessions within the community that we facilitate and manage. And this was one, I wish we would have had a bucket truck for this one. This was a recent project last fall in a recent outreach effort in Lake Forest Park, where we strung some umbrellas up in the sky, and we used umbrellas to mark a walking tour around the Lake Forest Park Town Center and help people kind of envision what the future possibilities could be for that area as it might transform in the future. So we got a lot of great experience with engagement. We also have a lot of experience in design of streets and civic campus areas. This is a project that we did that I managed in Twin Falls, Idaho, which was looking at redevelopment of a 7-block area in downtown, and a focus on creating really civic space and festival streets and a new community plaza where City Hall was being moved to in downtown. And I really wanted to show you this because the project itself, the planning and design process, was exactly the same time frame that we're planning for this project, really less than a year of time that we went through. We got a lot of public input through workshops and fun activities. We had a website where we engaged the community and got input through that. We put together different options for the street and the different blocks. You know, it looked at different street configurations and parking configurations. We put together preliminary design drawings and visualization concepts and gave people a sense of what things could look like in the future. This is the plaza that we did in preliminary design. Then we put together construction documents, which I don't have a picture of those because they're kind of boring. But here's a picture of the construction. So that happened really quickly. And we started this project in the fall of 2014, and construction was actually completed in late 2017. So last year, 2018, this is what the project area looked like. It was completed. The community is super excited. They went ice skating in their Civic Plaza, which was one of the dreams and hopes that they had that was identified as part of our visioning process. And also the kids get to play in the splash pad fountain area, which was another dream that the community had and the next generation kids had. So we're pretty excited to be able to have that role on these projects. We've done a lot of work in communities related to streets. This is a street design project on the left side for Tigard, Oregon. The Inner Urban Trail, which a lot of you folks are probably familiar with. This is the shoreline area of the Inner Urban Trail. We designed that project. I think that's important to think about because we know North Creek Trail runs through this sub-area, and there's an opportunity to enhance and expand and improve connectivity to that. We are doing the North Creek Trail for Snohomish County to the south of here. Yes, we are. And then we have team members who have been and are working on the Swift blue, green, and orange lines, and they're part of our team as well. And we know that there's an interest in having the orange line come through Mill Creek Boulevard, so we're going to be looking at that and assessing, you know, what we would need to do as far as improvements to make that happen, working with community transit on that. We've done a lot of work looking at how to co-locate stormwater facilities and parks, and I think that's also another interesting opportunity that we have in the sub-area. We've done a lot of transit-oriented development, you know, the architecture, and then working with developers to implement that. And then the last thing that I wanted to highlight is we have a lot of experience working on civic campuses and festival streets, which can be shared spaces where you have farmers markets and events and festivals as part of your civic campus. And so we see this project as a great opportunity to enhance this area and really make it feel like the heart of the community, connected to town center, and introduce maybe some better connectivity to North Creek Trail and other areas throughout this sub-area. So with that, I'm going to end my presentation, and we can take some input and discussion or take questions that you might have. So thank you. Yes.
Not a question.
Okay.
The process, it sounds like what you're going to do is to get a lot of input. You know, you guys see that.
Exactly, yes.
And where some opportunities might arise, and
getting input from all these various groups about those opportunities sounds great. It would be great to see that in this project, you take some time with your fresh eyes, because you're not a concrete council person, or you're not a, you know, on the public works here, which we are a little colored to what we see out there.
Take a look at everything, and I think that kind of research being brought to the groups will be a far more productive than just going to the groups and asking for their input. I do think the more information you can give us in the beginning, the more it can help us to decide what's the best use of this area.
Yes, I think you're right on, and that is part of our process. So I mentioned the review and assess step. So that really happens before we have our first workshop series, including looking at not only the assets of our great community, what we have, but also maybe what's needed, and talking with property owners a little bit about their plans and assessing the market potential. So that's definitely, you're right on point. That's definitely what our plan is. Yeah.
I love the process of doing the workshops and bringing everyone involved, including the kids. That is really fun. I would want to make sure that we are doing these workshops at a time when we can get the most, or more citizens to come in, make sure it's accessible to more people. You know what I'm trying to say, make sure it's at a time where we can get everyone in. But I love the idea of bringing them in for their input, because they need to feel like they're part of this process, and if we walk them along with us and they're partnering with us on this, they're going to be more excited about it. It's going to be their vision.
Yeah, I thought I would. Thank you. I thought I would bring up the schedule again just to kind of, oops, sorry. Yeah, it's hard to go backwards.
It shouldn't be our vision. Yeah. It should be theirs.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to address the timing then, as far as what we've been thinking, I guess, here we go. So the whole idea of this early review and assessment, we would get going on that this spring and summer, and then have visioning workshops, I guess, you know, somewhere in there. We're talking about June to start the visioning process, and I think that's a good time. We'll have to check and see when schools, you know, are in session, how we might organize engagement with the schools. But then we also have our scenarios workshop planned for this fall, which the scenarios is really when we're the visioning is a lot about words and goals and objectives, thinking about, you know, what the potential could be in terms of policies. But the scenarios is getting into more about what things could look like and what types of improvements and features people would like to see. So the fall is a really important time and a good time to engage the schools as well, the kids as well. So, yeah.
Finally get to use this. I'm glad we're getting around to this. No, this is much needed. We need to come up with this vision for what this might look like a number of years down the road. At the same time, I would encourage you to start with the property owners. We have to remember we're dealing with, while we're planning for our community, we're dealing with private property rights, and we have to be sensitive to something being, if we pursue something and adopt regulations, that has legal consequences for them in terms of creating non-conforming uses and that sort of thing. And so I want to avoid a situation where the community gets out in front of the market, and I don't want to end up having the same discussions we had with eGov, that we'd love a Nordstrom, we'd love an REI, we'd love a lot of things that are never going to happen. And so I would hate to see this process head down the unrealistic as opposed to the realistic and the possible. But I think this is a needed process, and I'll be interested to hear what the property owners have to say. I know when we were doing the eGov a couple years ago, the city manager and I, you recall, met with Tim Panos Jr. and Tim Russell, who's a resident but works in the business, doesn't have any projects in the city. But I was a little bit surprised, because at that time, granted that was 3 years ago, Tim Panos didn't express a big desire to undertake anything big. Now, it's not to say we shouldn't be looking at this, but and maybe they've changed, but I think it's important to get those property owners engaged early and bought into their involvement in the process. So that's all.
Yeah.
It's just an observation, and this is what we see right now going on in Elk Creek, which is going to become the basis for our discussions and decisions on what we do with the board. I'd like to see us review that prior to the actual input from the various groups. I think just to make sure that we know that that would really help.
And so just to clarify, when you say us, are you referring to having a presentation to City Council
yes.
on that particular piece of work? Okay, sure.
On the assessment stage, on the
yeah.
recommendations from the assessment stage.
Okay.
Not recommendations what we're going
to
do.
Right. Okay, got it, yeah.
Question, one thing I didn't see in the materials, are we going to have a map that defines the area that we're talking about planning for? I mean, is it town center at the north, and are we going south of 164th or north of 164th?
Yeah, so it does go south of 164th to encompass the commercial uses to the south where QFC and Mud Bay and those shops are. And then all the way to the north to where the town center starts.
There's a rough, yeah.
RFQ, which we established before.
The boundaries.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we have planned for that as part of our process. We have, I believe, five briefings from our team where we would come and give presentations. One of those could be the assessment, market assessment results. And then I know staff, as in addition to those five, would also be giving you regular updates as far as what we're doing. So that's the plan.
Yeah, thanks. I'm really excited that Councilmember Holzkopf said it right. I'm excited that we're finally getting around to it. I lost my round to it, but I appreciate that. This is something we've been talking about for a long time. I remember having discussions with Bill Trim way, way, way back about his dream of having Mill Creek or having Main Street extend on down somehow past Panos' shopping center to 164. I remember a retreat council had over in the basement of Sean O'Donnell's where Councilmember Bond said, gosh, our gateway to the city was at the time the Jet Tavern 164th.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just like that was not the right impression. We had this wonderful new town center, but you kind of got to it through a funny approach. I'm always frustrated in Mill Creek Boulevard how many people take the opportunity to turn left at the famous flashing yellow and cut through town to get to Boston Everett Highway. And in past years, I don't think it's on our plan anymore, but in past years we've said we're going to have to put a traffic light in 161st by Bank of America, and you can't get in and out of the post office. And those folks are not folks who are stopping and shopping or local residents. Those are folks who are just cutting through town and going on through. So these things have all been stewing for me, is what can we do to help the economic development from our legacy commercial center, which includes this building on South, but the opportunity to make that a more attractive part of Mill Creek to kind of continue with town centers. This is fantastic. The light bulb went off in even brighter for me when on my community transit role, and Mandy knows this, that the preliminary plan for the Orange Line, which will go from Mill Creek through Linwood Transit Center to connect light rail and on over to Edmonds Community College, they've got $5 million penciled in for improvements at McCollum Park to be able to turn buses around because they can't turn them around here. That doesn't count the extra operations of driving the buses from where it hits the green line right here all the way up to McCollum Park and back. So I just go, it's not our money, but it's our taxpayers' money collectively. If there's some way we can work closely with community transit on their schedule to get the buses turned around in Mill Creek, I think that's a coup for us in terms of the desirability of Mill Creek for future employers and residents. But it's also a saving of taxpayer dollars. Whether they're federal dollars or local dollars, that's an expensive project. Those projects are expensive, and I'd love to save that money. So this is great we're doing this. It's going to be difficult. I'm with other council members. The trick is to not let the – as much as you want to say this, we want to brainstorm and get all kinds of wonderful, broad-ranging ideas from the community, you got to be careful that it's within the bounds of what makes sense for us. And so I like this idea of a really – firm check-in with council and staff before we go from that assessment stage to the open it up to the public to start putting sticky notes up there, because they'll get all. We're going to have a Cheesecake Factory. We're going to have a Nordstrom. We're going to have a, you know, whatever. And that's, yeah. And and then people are disappointed because we haven't considered that. And the trick is we have considered it, but we were looking at what's economically feasible and looking at what's good for these property owners. Again, the property owners got to be involved. And if Mr. Panos doesn't want to participate in this particular plan, we just don't want to cut him off from future things because he is a significant tax revenue source for us and a significant part of our community, et cetera. So whether they say, this is great, I'm going to remodel my building or not, it's more do we set up an environment where they want to continue to be a business partner for us here in the city. So thanks.
So I can speak a little bit about that. Actually, today is the first day that we advertise the Type F, the Class F failures, and it's a package with 20 sites, including three or four sites that are Mill Creek Boulevard. However, those failures and the repair of those failures are surgical in nature. Some are jetting of pipes, and some are fixing the pipes at a specific location, but we're not replacing lines and lines of surface water pipe. So those are the F failures. We need to address those. In addition to those, we have a series of C failures, and those we do not want to touch until we complete this project.
But you'll be able to take care of the F failures.
Well, that's what we're going to be looking at. What can we include in this project that addresses the C failures in the future, but the F failures are being addressed the summer.
No, this matter is coming back to you next week, but I would ask that you give some thought to how you want to appoint the steering committee, the process that you want to utilize for nominating and then appointing up to, I think you've identified 15 members, at least the consultant has identified 15 members for you to consider. So staff will provide you more information, but if you could start giving some thought to that.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. I would say if staff has got an outline of what you think might be good on the committee, I think it'd be helpful, but I think we also should think about it, but I think it would be helpful to kind of think about, you know, if we're talking about property owners, how many are there really? You know, it's probably not practical to include all of them, but it'd be interesting to know how many property owners are in this, or I don't know. How do we get a representative group?
We could prepare an outline for you. It's not something you need to do at the same time that you approve the contract, but pretty soon thereafter we'll want to have that committee set up.
I kind of like where Councilmember Todd is going. What I'd like to see from the staff, though, is of these 15 people that you're looking for, their recommendations. Two should come from property owners, two should come from here, two should come from here. I'd like to see what they think and the consultant thinks would be the best representation. So we don't put six property owners in there or, God forbid, six council members in there, you know, whatever it might be. I think it'd be good to see what right looks like without names yet, and then we can have that discussion. I like that.
You have to stay lucky.
I saw the hand signs.
Yes, so I'm back. So our last study session item this evening is a topic that I just named Parks Vision Meeting. And this is the first of what will likely be several discussions that you will have, as well as maybe several discussions that you'll have with the community about what types of land uses, what types of parks and recreational amenities will be put on three properties, Dobson, Remillard, and Cook. Although we've talked about Cook more recently in regards to a public works facility, you all know when that property was purchased, 5-acre tract, significantly reduced in terms of the development capability of that land, given the wetlands or the distances from the creek. But in 2004, city purchased these three properties, Cook or Dobson, Remillard, and Cook, next to the Mill Creek Sports Park, which was also purchased in just a few years earlier in 2001. And the purpose of the purchases of those three properties was to provide a space for park and recreational amenities and activities to occur. And of course, the Cook property more specifically was talked about at that time as a location for a public works facility and a storage yard. So tonight's meeting, along with initial meetings that you'll hold on this topic, is really about big ideas and bold visions. And so I thought I would just lead off by calling out a quote: if you can visualize it, if you can dream it, there is a way to do it. This is an aerial of the three properties, Cook, Dobson, and Remillard, again, that the city purchased in 2004, that is adjacent to the sports park in the lower right corner. These are some of the past ideas that you've talked about over the years. Expansion of the sports park, again, which was an initial theme when those properties were purchased, a baseball, softball field, soccer field, community center, boys and girls club, library, public works facility that we just spoke of. So those are all the things that probably received the most sort of focus in the discussions that you've had over the years. There may have been other items, but those are the main ones that you've talked about. And then some more current ideas are centered around a multi-use facility, things that could serve a lot of different interests, whether it's hockey, baseball, softball field, batting cages, lacrosse, soccer, basketball, classroom, restaurant, cafes. Again, trying to create some energy and enough excitement that would really move the needle in terms of economic development as well as supporting the recreation needs of Mill Creek and the surrounding areas. A little furthermore, in terms of inspirations, the photo on the left is a diagram that I think you probably saw in your agenda packets in 2015. It just shows how you would lay out a couple of baseball fields and soccer fields on the 10 acres. Now we're going to mostly focus on the Dobson and the Remillard property and sort of putting aside for the moment the Cook property. But this simply illustration was showing you could probably get two fields on those 10 acres along with parking and some other development. The photo on the right, the image on the right, is what if you wanted a multi-purpose building or a hockey, lacrosse, sort of indoor use type facility, and that's what's shown on the right, illustrating sort of two sheets of ice along with parking on one of the 5-acre tracks. These are just a collection of images that I put together that would really meant to kind of inspire your thinking about what you could possibly put. Maybe a bit too ambitious is the large aquatic center with a roof that can shut and open during the sunshine in the Northwest, but you have some other things there that are probably realistic in terms of the discussions that you've been having. This is the Mill Creek Sports Park, of course, that sort of the jewel of the city's recreation system as it is today, or as it was maybe a few years ago. It'll be reopened again later this week, we hope. More inspirational photos. This is just an image of a collection of fields, and maybe this is something that Mill Creek Sports Park could have two or three sort of fields replicated in this sort of fashion. And the agenda summary indicated that there's generally sort of three types of approaches you can move forward with, really in most all types of development, and certainly in parks and recreation. The one is just the traditional approach, where the city government designs the facility, funds the facility, and then builds the facility. Pretty straightforward, sort of right over tackle type development requires funds, of course, to do that. The next is public partnerships. This would be a public partnership with another service agency. It could be the Boys and Girls Club, the YMCA, any other group that's missions also park and recreation, to the extent that your collective talents and your funds and resources can be combined to bring about a project that organically couldn't have happened otherwise. And the last is a public-private partnership, in that you're looking to the private sector to come on board. You're offering them something in return for the private sector to provide that wouldn't necessarily, again, organically just materialize without that private sector involvement. These are, again, just some of the agencies that I've held some preliminary discussions with. There's more agencies that could partner with, but trying to stretch the resources as much as possible in order to build a facility that's unique and serves as a great attraction includes amateur hockey, YMCA, Boys and Girls Club, Mill Creek Little League. And so we'll finish with sort of this really brief presentation and just to ask you and start thinking about what are some of your ideas, current ideas, that will then start to shape sort of our next steps forward. And in terms of our next steps, we have included $50,000 in the budget. That budget was meant to include some basic illustrations, or could include some basic illustrations, desired uses, public engagement possibly, as well as some strategies to achieve that goal. That would be a planning feasibility study or planning process and determine what is going to go in Dobson-Remillard and then how you're going to achieve it. And so tonight's discussion was really just to listen, to hear your thoughts about what are some ideas that you have for these two properties.
I got some thoughts. First, I'd like to recognize that Tina Ryan from the Mill Creek Little League, the current president, is here tonight. I guess I start by the way I look at this. I've come up with some guiding principles, and there's really three. Whatever we do with this site, in my opinion, first has to be a community asset that has a benefit to the community, and particularly for me, if it's some benefit to youth. It's got to be an asset that can help drive economic development for our city. And third, it's got to be revenue positive. Those are kind of the three themes for me that drive this. Recall back in 2014 when we had the discussion with the Boys and Girls Club. The conversation was, the concept was they build a facility, or the property is deeded to them to build their facility. They do the fundraising for a facility and to make a pad for a new field. And then when they're done with their construction, they deed it back to us. They lease it back on $1 a month. But then instead of funding a whole field, they've done all the earthwork, and we are just looking at building a field on top of it. Nothing came of that. As we've discussed, the Hockey Association has expressed some interest, although now it might be a little bit on the back burner with their present proposal that they're pursuing out in Snoqualmie. But from the discussion Bob and I had with them in December, when we finally got to the point where we were asking them, give us some numbers so we can see if there's something even realistic here. And I think what I took from that meeting was it's going to be hard to do something like that for a one-use pony. it's really going to need to take some kind of multi-use facility, which is why we wanted to then go back and inquire with Bill Sokolos of the Boys and Girls Club, is there still an interest, which I took from our meeting with them that there is. But there's a lot of different groups that have different needs. The YMCA has needs during summer for summer camp. They have needs after school and before school, same with the Boys and Girls Club. Little League needs a permanent home or desires a permanent home, could use a training facility. One thing worth considering, too, is I forget how many years ago was it, Tina? 3 years ago that the Little League won the award from the National Little League Association, where they have a lighting package for a new field that the Little League is going to give to them once they have a place to put it. There was some discussion putting out at Willis Tucker that became impracticable. So if there were to be part of this vision a new baseball field there, the Little League would likely be able to bring to it a lighting package with it. So I think there's an opportunity for us to get creative here and come up with something pretty cool. There are examples of this. I would encourage you in your free time to look up the Aspen Recreation Center. It is a bigger scale than this, and it has water facilities, which I'm not exactly sure that I'm in favor of Donna Michelson's water park. But I think there's some other uses here. I think there's an opportunity to really come up with a unique proposal here that could be a great benefit to our community. So, and there's a lot of different players that could go into that and a lot of different segments of our community we could address. So I'm excited.
I'm going to throw a curve, a new thought, not too surprising to some of you. Having raised all my kids here in Mill Creek, they went through Mill Creek Elementary, they went to Heatherwood, they went to Jackson. What was interesting at all these schools was these schools, including the elementary school, had very large sports facilities built into them, from the elementary school grounds to the basketball courts and fields at Heatherwood to the same huge indoor basketball court at Jackson and the field. What was interesting was in none of our schools was something a lot of us had when we grew up, and that was called an auditorium. They didn't have it. They didn't have a place to present, perform. There was not a strong support of the arts in the school system. So what is interesting today, if you look, the Heatherwood, I know of Heatherwood and Jackson in particular, despite the fact that they never built an arts facility for them, there are six band programs, two choirs. There's a huge drama program built at Jackson without a theater. And the same thing at Heatherwood has built a huge theater program, which they are performing every year. So what is interesting is that there's what I'm concerned about is a support for the arts in Mill Creek. So I went out and I met with the Performing Arts Center at Kirkland. I met with the Performing Arts Center in Edmonds and talked to them about their facilities that were created and how they support them and how they fund them. And, each one's a little bit different. But in our case, I would be intrigued to explore the citizens' appreciation right now or interest in a Performing Arts Center, something we don't have. We have some good sports, great sports. My kids enjoyed those sports. Thank you very much. But what we don't have, I always like to assess what we have and what we don't have. We don't have a facility for all the schools in Mill Creek to perform in. They have to go to Everett. They have to go to other places to perform, which is a shame. The families go with them. The parents go with them. They go to dinner up there. I'd like to see them enjoy a performance facility here in Mill Creek. I'd like to see the arts supported. I'd like to see an opportunity. What the Performing Arts Centers told me was these are substantial revenue producers for them as well, because these facilities that are built as Performing Arts Centers with quality production facilities attract, I gotta say it, a B-level talent. You're not gonna get Paul McCartney performing here, but the Lyle Lovett's, the more funky groups that want to come through and perform in a smaller facility. I'm thinking 300, 400 seat facility. I think these properties would give us a great potential site. There is support, obviously, from state legislative money for the arts. There's also support from the county and bigger support from the private sector, which obviously want naming rights and other abilities to build into these kinds of things. So I'd like to see us take a look from a vision standpoint at providing something that Mill Creek certainly doesn't provide, especially to the students of our three schools, which don't have a place to perform, to meet, to have, you know, they could do it in a gym, in bleachers, but, you know, not a very comfortable place and definitely not a place to perform. So I think an opportunity for us would be to take a look at these sites as a potential for a performing arts center. It's going to take a lot more research, a lot of information about cost, you know, maintaining them. How are we going to pay for it? I think it's going to be like building it's going to be the easier part. You got to maintain it. And there's a process to that, which I know we would have to study and talk about.
John, do you know how many seats at the new Linwood High School where the chorale performed last year? Do you know how many seats that is?
I believe that is 400.
400?
Okay. Which is a great auditorium.
It is, and I agree, and I don't know if some of you remember, we had a gentleman 3 or 4 years ago come in and testify to us on this very thing about the need for art space. I don't think they're necessarily mutually exclusive. I think there's an opportunity here with the 10 acres to possibly do a community facility that incorporates a Boys and Girls Club, community space, and an auditorium of, you know, along the lines of the size that Linwood has, and also have some recreational amenities. So I think we have a lot of options. I think we should look at all of them.
Not an either or, it's in addition to.
Bob may know the answer to this, he may not. many years ago, down in, I'm going to say Canyon Park, but this might be wrong, there was office buildings built and some fields were created down there. And so I've always viewed it as kind of interesting. I don't know exactly how those were funded, but I suspect part of the advantage is the office buildings all day long need the parking lots, and then people go home, and the parking is available in evenings and weekends for users of those fields. And those kind of ideas are interesting to me. Many years ago, Mark may remember, I think it was early on, somebody came to us and said, gosh, would you let us buy part of Dobson because we got an idea for an office building and we want to switch things around. At the time, we were not interested. But that is office zoned up there. How does that kind of thing work? You talked about public-private kinds of things. Are there potentially private developers for the corner to the north of the Kelly property that would something that we should also consider when we're looking at this study?
Potentially, I mean, a public-private partnership could be that allowing someone to do something on land that you own in exchange for that party developing something that you otherwise couldn't afford.
Yeah.
And so you may have to share some space, or it could mean that you share expenses or maybe share a parking facility. Everybody needs parking for whether it's recreation use or some other private revenue-producing uses. What happened in the Canyon Park area was you could call it a public-private partnership, although a lot of it was done through regulatory control by when those improvements were authorized, a combination of, one, land being donated, two, mitigation funds being applied, and then grant dollars. And so it was a lot of different sources of funds went into that. The last field in those areas was largely funded by King County Metro mitigation dollars, but it's a good use. That, I mean, the area that, that Councilmember Todd is talking about is in within a business park, and so field use is typically after hours or on the weekends, and so you had built-in parking that could accommodate the use of four or five synthetic surface fields and didn't have necessarily the residential impacts with them being lighted either. So it was a good scenario. This would be, of course, on a much smaller scale to whether or not you could entice enough business and then occupy enough space on 10 acres. Probably not. But there are some other public-private partnerships I think you could explore in addition to the public agency to public agency partnership that we talked about with the Boys and Girls Club or Performing Arts Center for Nonprofit or Mill Creek Little League or someone similar.
Well, we're kind of between Painfield Industrial Center, which has a lot of jobs, and Bothell, the biomed kind of stuff. And the Economic Alliance and before said, well, if you can tell us what kind of opportunities we should help you look for, their business is economic development kinds of things. It's not really a big enough site for a big office building, but I keep thinking, is there somebody who needs satellite offices for expansion, and it's, or they want to be close to Boeing or close to the biomed area? It's not perfect, but I keep looking, is there somebody, some way to do that and have somebody help with the development of something that would be a nice asset for the city? Because the cost of it is one thing, and then the maintenance and the operations is another thing. None of these projects we just talked about are cheap.
Could be. I mean, small office space such as co-working space.
Yeah.
Where you don't necessarily have a tenant, but someone needs, 100 square feet, or they need an office for a day, or they need it for a week. So those are becoming more popular in this area.
Thanks.
A lot going on here because I'm daydreaming about this. 100% agree with what you made a good case for a performing arts center, and I'm on board. We need one, and I would like to see one. My vision would be somehow get that beautiful facility a little more closer to town center or something and have it kind of a destination of its own. But I love it, and I'm on board with that, and I would encourage any conversations we had to act on that and not just let it die on the vine. We've got something started here, and my vision has always been to build on it. And I think we have a great opportunity with what we've got. I wouldn't want, I've stood against, was not in favor of a public works yard, although we need one. I didn't want to use Cook. Because if, or anything else, if we can find a way to get three fields in here. First, okay, premise, we have a shortage of fields. That's a fact. We don't have enough ball fields for Little League, for softball for the girls, for the soccer players, boys and girls, and now lacrosse, which has kind of come on the radar and seems to be getting traction. So that's my premise. We have a shortage of fields. So, and that's a big we. That's Snohomish County. That's everywhere. So I don't want to lose an opportunity to squeeze a couple fields in here. I would love to sort of daydream even a bigger footprint if we could work with some other folks in that area. But if we're looking at what we have, to somehow get three fields in allows for the tournaments. And from what I've heard, that brings a lot of folks in and can be a revenue stream of sorts. And I like the idea of whatever we do should be revenues positive. Yes and no. Depends on how ambitious we go. If we're putting in a skating rink, it's got to pay for itself. We're putting in nature trails, those don't have to pay for themselves. We put in a public restroom, those don't pay for themselves. So how ambitious a project we get, the sports park currently does not pay for itself, right? So it just depends on where we're going with it. But I think we've got an opportunity here, and I think it's good to sort of dream big and get out of the box a little bit and see what we could stumble into. So I'm not against anything but that's been said tonight, including a performing arts center there, because we just have no other place to put it, and it's the best. At the end of the day, we decide that's the best use for this property. But My vision is we're building on what we already have. We've got something there. It's not quite big enough to do the things we'd like to. For baseball, it's too short or whatever, right? They can't do adult leagues. So we've missed. There is opportunity that we're currently missing. Adult leagues do pay revenues. I don't know how much they generate with Parks and Rec dollars, but I don't know. There's a lot of opportunity here, and that's the problem. Has been we don't end up making any decisions, and we don't move forward. We just have lots of opportunity, and we never move on.
The challenge with all this is going to be the capital costs associated with either building fields or building buildings. I mean, it's going to be significant, and you're never going to be able to put enough activity there in order to pay that back. So you have to make an investment. So how do you make that investment, or how do you share that burden? And one way to do that is to look for partnerships to share those expenses with, whether it be public or private. I mean, the traditional way, of course, is just through taxation, your property tax or sales taxes. Also, cities have built facilities by expanding their tax base outside of your municipal boundaries. So a park and recreation service area or metropolitan park district, all it does is just create a new taxing boundary from which those residents within or citizens within those districts would then contribute. And so you'd want to set a boundary that was based on whatever you're building there is that servicing that area, in other words. Because most likely there are people are going to be, if you build something great enough, people from outside your community are going to come use it and visit it. And so that's the argument of really kind of expanding in, if you're going to have a tax boundary, to expand it outside of your existing city limits.
Bob, what do you suggest? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm listening to everyone, and I would put myself in line with Brian. When I look at what we can do with the property, I would like to see us look at ways where we could be building economic growth around some activities for the youth. So I fall in line with what he's saying, and I think that it's not overly ambitious for us to think that this should be something that is bringing in revenue as well and still giving back to the community and our children. So as we're looking at whatever this is that we're going to end up doing, I feel that it does need to meet all three of Brian's criteria that he's laid out there, and I think that we're more than capable of coming up with something very exciting to meet those criteria.
Yeah, I was going to ask, so what is our next step? How do we get that big rock moving forward to at least put together some options? I mean, do we use the money that we set aside in the budget to hire a consultant to work with staff to help us come up with concepts? I mean, in my mind, we should be looking at an all-fields option. We should be looking at, you know, a Boys and Girls Club and a box that could be filled with who knows what, whether it's an indoor facility for basketball courts and lacrosse rinks, and how we could incorporate a performing arts center into that. I'd like to see maybe the next meeting a beginning of a work plan to move us forward, to help us have these discussions, to put together some framework of ideas so we know what's realistic and what's not.
I think that would help if you had someone brought on board that could do some basic illustrations for you so that you can use those as sort of talking boards, if you will, as you engage the community about what they like to see there. And then you need to have a discussion about developing some strategies about how you get there. What kind of partnerships do you have to pursue? I wouldn't say it'd be a mini sort of sub-area plan, but it'd be very, very focused on parks and recreation, maybe some other land uses that help you bring in the parks and recreation stuff that you want. But it's going to be a combination, I think, of staff time and the consultant time based on sort of where I think you want to end up and what you have available in the budget.
Yeah, and going back to the first slide, I don't know what others think. I don't want to know the dollars first. I want to know the vision.
Right.
and then figure out if we can get there, because I'm afraid that if we look at the dollars first, we're just going to do this and not move forward on anything. So I'd rather look at what our options are for whatever it may be, what do the visioning process, and then figure out what the costs are and if and how we can make it happen, so then we can get to some decisions.
Given the proximity to Bothlevert Highway, I see a very unique opportunity for partnerships with business, whether it's hospitality. Mike talked about office space. I probably have to see what that looked like, but I think we're building a theme down there with the ball fields, the skate park, and whatnot, and we have a very unique opportunity with those parcels and Bothlevert Highway's proximity, 132nd. I think this could be a home run if we put our collective heads together. And one thing, I'm not a big tax guy, but I've advocated for a while about creating a taxing district. So that could essentially be the heartbeat or the lifeblood for future economic funds flowing through that area. Many cities have done it, whether it's a sports and entertainment tax that they put on there or a hospitality fee like in SeaTac and some other places. They work. They create funds that the city's able to use and can forecast for the future, and these what-if conversations are very legitimate once you have, you know, some sort of forecasting of what sort of income will be coming in. So that's where I stand. I like the open space idea and the fields. I think it's a home run, an adjacent ball field. I think we could be the gem of and envy of other cities that have this centerpiece in the city of athletics. That's it. Thanks.
Can I just echo one thing? I'm sorry.
Well, go ahead.
I was going to say that every redevelopment project I've worked on, from Mill Creek to Bothell, to Eastern Washington, some other cities I've worked on recently, they all start with a dream. And at the very beginning, the costs seem almost insurmountable. But those cities and those jurisdictions that are able to sort of just have the conviction and know that, you know, the power of the community's dream really does help move projects along. And so I think it's a good point not to get hung up on the cost, because the costs are going to be large. With even two fills is probably $10 million plus. If you throw a facility on the performing arts, now you're into $30, $40, $50 million. And that seems like a big barrier that you can never overachieve, but I wouldn't allow that to sort of sway you in terms of what your grand vision is, and just keep working at it. Those cities who have been successful have done just that.
Well, you gave the summary statement, so you can have a summary statement after I make my statement here, too. So I've been engaged in the field business since 1999, and we have not come very far since 1999. We've got Mill Creek Sports Park, but in terms of my long legacy of fields in this community, it's been a difficult thing for us, and I think it's often because they're expensive. They're really expensive unless you've already got a flat piece of dirt somewhere, which is in Ellensburg or Yakima or Tri-Cities. It doesn't happen to be around here. It's not flat and dry, so it's always tough. And I like this idea of visioning, and I agree we need to dream big and don't let the dollars get in the way, but I think we need to have a little bit of reality check, back of the envelope is what I would call it. So Bob just gave some back of the envelope kind of numbers. If you're dreaming of a couple of fields, you ought to be thinking round numbers, it's $10 million bucks. It's not, we're going to do this out of pocket change. If you're thinking Performing Arts Center, it's $500 a square foot times whatever. We just ought to have those kinds of back-of-the-envelope numbers just so that we don't get too crazy. And, again, have the community get ahead of us in, oh, we ought to have this, we ought to have that, when that's just going to be frustrating to us. Because we've been down this path many times before, and we've always run into, we don't have $18 million. We don't have $15 million. We spent a lot of time, I was on the Parks Board at the time and then on council, spent a lot of time designing a rec center, you know, as part of the town center. And we got all done. We'd spent several hundred thousand dollars on design and figured out that, oh, it was never going to pay for itself. The M&O was going to kill us. If we could find the several $1 million to build it, that was one thing, but we could never find a plan to make it pay for itself. Well, it'd be great to have more gyms. It'd be great to have more a community space for a few events a year, but we couldn't figure out how to make it work. So I don't want to, I'm sorry I'm being the wet blanket on this, but I think just having an appreciation, not the specific numbers, but the broad numbers, help us keep from going too far beyond what's a vision that we could have for the bigger community. And I agree, we need to figure out how to somehow incorporate the folks beyond Mill Creek's 4.6 square miles. It's a lot of folks that call Mill Creek, Mill Creek. It's the greater Mill Creek that's not a part of our incorporated city that already are benefiting from Mill Creek Sports Park and other things, all the other fantastic parks. Metropolitan Park districts, like you said, are a way to do that, but it's tough to get people outside of the city to sign up for new taxes. But I think we also ought to look at that and say, is there a way to draw a bigger boundary to make this a something that's more attractable financially? Thanks.
I agree with you. I think a vision plan is only as good as the plan that you create that achieves it. And so if you don't have an execution plan, then the plan is of really little value. So you just have to always remember, yes, dream big, but how are you going to implement it? And be prepared to have the conviction to implement it if it's so big that it takes multiple years.
Yeah.
Yes.
Number 5975 through 60117 and ACA wire transfers in the amount of $1,858,412.17. Audit Committee Pruitt and Holtzclaw, no exceptions?
No exceptions.
Payroll and benefit ACH payments in the amount of $287,781.64, no exceptions?
No exceptions.
Payroll and benefit ACH payments in the amount of $207,787.13, no exceptions?
No exceptions.
And City Council meeting minutes of December 12, 2018. Do we have a motion to approve the consent agenda?
So moved.
Second.
Motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Passes unanimously. We're down to reports. I'd like to remind everybody, if you haven't yet, please get your F1s in. To the Public Disclosure Commission. They're due April 15th. And the last I saw,
I wanted to bring everybody's attention to the event that's happening this Thursday at Arena Sports. I believe it's the chamber that is supporting and creating this event where they're asking all of the community service organizations in the city to come together, and there's a hosted event there so that the public can come in and meet all these different opportunities like Kiwanis or Rotary or Lions Club and a few others that are going to be there as well. So hopefully a lot of citizens appreciate any support that the council can provide, or city employees, or their I know you're going to, the city has a booth as well, so we'll be there and represented as well. So I think it'd be great to, you know, come out if you can, but it's going to be a nice community event to bring the community together and show them, especially with Volunteer Week, how you can volunteer. That's it.
And can you give us lotto numbers, too, when you're predicting the weather?
What I'll say is tomorrow we have a meeting, but for the project itself. But
the weather required for this part, this phase of the field turf needs to be dry, and we haven't had that. So, so there hasn't been that many workers out in the field this week because of that, and that has set us back. Well, as far as the event itself, you know,
field's not open.
Okay.
There's no event.
Okay.
But we'll know more tomorrow whether or not what the weather holds for us and whether or not the contractors can finish their work for the opening.
Can you shoot us an email?
Yes.
I hope to be at the event Thursday night. And I was contacted by Jeff Thomas, one of the board members of the chamber, and had coffee with him earlier this week. I don't know about the others. I would be interested in having the chamber at some point soon come and give a presentation of what they're up to and how they're evolving from the business association into a chamber. So I don't know if others would see a benefit in that, but I think that would be a good idea. The other thing I'll mention, I attended the Southwest UGA Boundary Study Workshop put on by the county. Their draft report is due sometime in May, and I guess in the spirit of brevity, I'll just say that I think there's a lot of denial about the challenge our region faces for accommodating the growth that's projected in the next 30 years. And I'll leave it at that. That's all I had tonight.
I got a question on the event Thursday. I just remember last year there was booths to wander around, but there was also some presentations, and I did a poor job of scheduling my time. Do we know, is there a schedule to that? We may not know. Maybe somebody else
there
is
not
doing
presentations this year. The format was changed largely because those were not viewed favorably.
Okay.
So they are doing more of the booth informal approach, but come and recognize the volunteers.
So people can really drop in anytime between, is it 4 and 7?
Correct.
Drop in and do whatever, so you don't have to rush to be there at 4:30.
Correct.
Come and hang out for a while. Thank you. That'll be great. It was a good event last year.
No reports.
Carmen Fisher, 14623 Main Street, apartment B101. So first, on the Comcast settlement, I think that my concern is, if I understand it correctly, if we don't enact the settlement, we took a $92,000 loss and then added attorney's fees and the audit fees and wasted the staff's time. And I'm not necessarily saying that settlement should be enacted, but it just gives me a concern about inefficiency in the system and whether we could have been more aligned between the staff and the council earlier on. And then also on that, while it's not a utility tax per se, it is a utility with extra money that goes to us, quacking ducks. And unfortunately for me, a lot of people remember that 2 years ago I advocated for a utility tax. Which was like purely and entirely for the reason that I had no idea of anything about anything. And being in this room, I've evolved on that. I've seen like the pride that Mill Creek takes in not having this tax. And I've come to the position that Council Member Bond expressed in a previous meeting, which is, only an emergency, only in a state of financial emergency. But if you pass on the settlement, because it's too much like a utility tax, I think you're also kind of saying that the 5% that we're already charging for franchise fees is a little bit maybe outside of the mandate of citizens. And I'm not necessarily saying that you should get rid of that either, but, just some logical consistency in opinion. I want to say I love the idea of an auditorium so much. In the town I grew up in, we got a really great performing arts center, and it was fantastic. It was such a point of pride for the community. Felt so good as a theater kid to be able to perform there. Churches were able to have like huge Easter and Christmas celebrations that brought them together. So I'm for that. I really want to compliment the council on your selection of city manager. Really excited about getting Michael in here. I have a lot of faith in him. And I just want to say, it's spring and it's so beautiful, and I just am really in love with Mill Creek. And I know you guys didn't make it spring. but a lot of you have been working here for a long time. The staff is incredible, and it's really beautiful. And I thought I'd express some appreciation for how great that is.
Thank you. Anybody else?
John Raymer with 831 148th Street Southeast. Councilman Steckler, I just want to say it's a brilliant idea. We really, a community public arts center, public performance center is fantastic. I'm a theater person. I've done it for 30 years, and I would absolutely love to be involved in that in any way, form, or fashion. I think that's fantastic. So I'm going to echo her comment there. And then I just went brain dead. I've been tired. I've been up for 14 hours. I wanted to say the OTEC lady, I'm sorry that she's left, but if you need to pick somebody for that committee, I'm volunteering. I think it's a fantastic idea. I would love to be involved with helping do something for the city for figure out what we're going to do for the next 10, 15 years. So if you need a city council person who lives here in Mill Creek on the committee, hi. I would love to do that. Sure, I'm there. I'm it. Oh, no, not city council. You have to twist my arm, ma'am.
File your records before a complaint follows you.
You have to talk to Councilman Steckler, and both of you twist my arm. But for this committee, for OTEC and this long-term thing, I would love to volunteer for that, honestly. So if you need somebody to step up, here I am. Thank you.
Evaluation of the qualifications of an applicant.
I'll move to extend up to 9:30.
Aye.
Opposed, extensions, passes unanimously, and now we're going to recess.
So they're not anticipating action? Okay, I didn't get your text.
Oh, you did? Sorry.
It's okay.
So
if Nate writes you, text me.
Vince didn't make it through the meeting, I did.
You too, thank you.
See you, John.